Good evening, everyone. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our Sunday evening call-in, the last one. Before I introduce our honored speaker for this evening, I want to mention there's some lots of interesting activity on the website. Here to look around. Videos are being posted of a recent conference with some very interesting presentations. And there's also developments in the world of electronic social media. You can now follow the NEA BPD on Twitter and get little tweets of what is going on, keep you up to date, as well as on Facebook, and of course, the regular web page. So things are really rolling along there. There are also now on the main web, if you look in the upper right-hand corner, it says donations, donate. And if you click on that, you will get a page that will offer you generally to the NEA BPD two specific aspects of the NEA BPD program activities. And while we rely substantially on volunteer efforts such as tonight, there are a number of things that do require money, so donations are very important and helpful. Our speaker tonight is Beth Brodsky, and we are really delighted to have her. She is unique in my experience over the decades. She's the only one that I can recall, researcher, clinician, who received her college and graduate school degrees in the same place that she was born and has worked for her career in the same place, namely New York City. She was born in the Queens, got her undergraduate degree at Cornell, and her master's and PhD at the New School for Social Work. And while in graduate work and getting near the PhD, she worked, fortunately for borderline personality disorder and us, was led to link up with a study of borderline. And that led to her dissertation on the relationship of borderline personality disorder to self-mutilation and child abuse. And she has continued with that subsequently. She has been trained by leaders in the field, including Otto Kernberg and Marsha Linehan. And in fact, this next Monday through Friday will be in a whole week intensive DBT training that Marsha Linehan has given in New York City. She splits her time clinically between private practice, that is about half time on that, and half time on the research. And she's involved in multiple grants. This is the grant that she's going to be talking to us tonight is called an R25, and it involves clinical training and DBT for self-harm for psychiatric residents. And she's also involved in a treatment study on suicidal behavior and self-mutilation, and in the therapy and safety planning for suicidal behavior. Those are current activities. She's had other involvements with other research previously, published a number of papers. She's been sought as a reviewer for research papers by 12 different journals. And she has rave reviews as a supervisor and a mentor for people in training. And she's an unquestioned DBT expert with a depth of experience. And she's open to questions not only about her presentation tonight, but more broadly about the field. So this is a person of great knowledge, expertise, and wisdom that you can tap into. So if you have questions, this is send them as soon as you can so we can organize them to cover as much as we can. Send your questions, as always, to the NEABPD@AOL.com. So with that, now we have a imaginary sounding of the trumpets and beating of the drums to formally introduce our speaker, Dr. Beth Brodsky.
Thank you so much, Jim, for that lovely introduction, and I'm so glad to be here to be able to talk about some of the work I'm doing and to answer any questions that people might have. The current research that I'm doing is that R25 that Jim mentioned. It's called the DBT for Self-Harm, a Clinical and Research Training for Psychiatry Residents, and I wanted to share it with you and also talk about some of the larger issues about what it means to train people early in their career to treat borderline personality disorder. So I'm going to start with an agenda because that's what we do in DBT. In order to stay focused, we talk about what we're going to do up front. So I'd like to describe the federally funded program to teach DBT. I'm on the next slide, by the way, to psychiatry residents, and that's taking place at Columbia University. First, I'm going to describe the problem that this program addresses, the fact that there's so much stigma towards borderline personality disorder and misconceptions about it among mental health providers, and that contributes to inadequate treatment. Then I'll talk about the objectives of the program to address the problem and share some preliminary results as well as the efforts to disseminate the program to other training programs. So we're in the fourth year of a five-year funded DBT curriculum. I'm a multiple principal investigator with Dr. Barbara Stanley. We received this grant, which is called an Educational Program of Excellence in Scientifically Validated Behavioral Treatment. And one of the areas of interest at the time when we applied for the grant was to show how we could use DBT to help people treat self-harm behaviors. So we developed a comprehensive clinical DBT training for residents to learn how to treat self-harm behaviors. This grant also goes along, in addition to the clinical training, we also include seminars related to the design and conduct of psychotherapy research because DBT and some of the other treatments for borderline personality disorder have an evidence base, and it's important for people, even if they don't engage in research, is to really understand what it means to do clinical research and to have the empirical base for the results. So you want to be able to understand why DBT works and how we know it works, and that's through research. So it's a very comprehensive curriculum that we've created, and partly we were able to do it because Columbia is a place that is such a rich research center where we have so many experts who are conducting research for suicidal behavior, not just borderline personality disorder, but for depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. And it's one of the few research centers in the country that include people at risk for suicidal behavior in clinical trials, which is very important because if you know that a treatment works for people, say, with depression, but then you read the literature and you see that they excluded people who are suicidal, then you don't really know whether the treatment is can be generalized to people who have suicidal behaviors. For example, antidepressant medications might be helpful in reducing depression, but if you don't do clinical trials including suicidal individuals, you don't know if those treatments are good for that. And so we're doing that kind of research at Columbia. So rationale for doing DBT clinical training and psychiatry residency program is that much effort has been made to develop and to test psychotherapy interventions designed to target suicidal and non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors. DBT is one of the ones with the most evidence base, but there are other treatments for borderline personality disorder, such as transference-focused psychotherapy, mentalization, psychotherapy schema therapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy. So a lot of treatments are being developed and tested, but there's much less effort to actually incorporate the treatments into training programs. So myself, I didn't learn DBT until after I was already out of graduate school with my degree, and I learned it because I was going to conduct research in it. So one of the goals of this grant is to try to reach people who are in their training, learning to be clinicians, whether they're being psychotherapists or psychopharmacologists, They need to be exposed to these evidence-based treatments. And psychiatrists in particular are often on the front lines in treating borderline personality disorder and suicidal behavior. Even if they're not doing psychotherapy, although psychiatrists still do want to do psychotherapy. I'm actually working with the group for the advancement of psychotherapy, of psychiatry in the psychotherapy committee, and we're working on a white paper to try to make the case for why psychiatrists still need to be trained and to conduct psychotherapy as well as psychopharmacology. I can talk more about that later. But we want psychiatrists, especially in training, to learn how to feel comfortable treating suicidal behavior and making good decisions about how to keep people safe outside the hospital as well as to know when to hospitalize. And also we need psychiatrists trained in DBT in order to be good collaborators with psychologists and social workers who are doing psychotherapy if there's a split treatment.
J-U-S-T.
Important is because it has a very big evidence base. Getting a little feedback on the line. Is everybody hearing me okay? I hope. Okay.
Listeners, would you please put your phones on mute?
DBT increases treatment retention. In other words, the studies that show the efficacy of DBT also show that patients are less likely to drop out of treatment. As I will review, the assumptions that DBT takes regarding people with borderline personality disorder really go a long way to destigmatize the disorder and challenges basic judgmental assumptions about individuals with BPD. And more than anything, I know DBT offers a lot of skills for patients, but I think even more, DBT helps clinicians stay therapeutically engaged with borderline patients, which is really crucial. Because the problem is this, and I'm on the next slide. I keep telling people, I forget to tell people to go to the next slide. So I'm on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm on the fifth slide now. The problem is, and the reason we need to train people to treat BPD is because the stigma that it carries. And, you know, most mental disorders carry a stigma in the larger lay community, but BPD is rare in being so stigmatized among mental health providers. And we have some ideas about why that is. A lot of clinicians believe that BPD is untreatable, and a lot of people choose when they can not to treat individuals with BPD. And the clinicians who are willing to treat them often experience burnout and have difficulty maintaining empathy. These patients have a hard time staying engaged in treatment, partly because of the disorder, and I think partly because treatments have not been able to address their particular symptoms and keep them engaged, and the therapist burns out. In standard clinical training for the treatment of suicidal behavior, often clinicians unnecessarily hospitalize their borderline patients, and standard clinical training does not train clinicians to understand how to treat non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. So often I have patients who come to me who've been hospitalized even though they've never been suicidal in their life because they've engaged in non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors. And while I do understand that that's a very scary and disturbing behavior, when you're trained to treat people with BPD and with those behaviors, you have more ability to distinguish between the risk that these individuals have for actually killing themselves. If they're engaging in non-suicidal self-harm, they might not be at such high risk, although that is a risk for engaging in suicidal behavior. It might not be an imminent risk. People who engage in non-suicidal self-injury often feel better after they've engaged in that behavior, and they're not suicidal at all afterwards. But it's hard. It's not if you, unless you have that kind of training. It's hard for you to make that decision as a clinician. So we've come to think in training people and thinking about it that there's a reason why there's such a stigma within the mental health profession towards these patients. The first is that the disorder presents with extreme clinical challenges, suicidal and self-harm behaviors, emotional and behavioral dysregulation, and a dependent, hostile, interpersonal style that is very difficult for anybody to tolerate. But then the clinicians, because these patients don't necessarily respond to the usual clinical approaches, clinicians tend to attribute some of the symptoms to willfulness and deliberate effort on the part of the patient to be difficult. And they use terms such as the patient is manipulative, demanding, attention-seeking, provocative, bad. If somebody had a disorder such as schizophrenia, they might not attribute the symptoms to the person being deliberately being that way. They attribute those symptoms to the illness. But individuals with BPD, because of, I think the symptoms are interpersonal, they have an interpersonal impact, because individuals with BPD have higher levels of functioning at times, it's hard to recognize the symptoms as part of the illness in this case. So the next slide is what I've just been saying, that I believe that there's a transaction between specific aspects of BPD pathology and symptomatology and the way that clinicians are taught when they're trained in treatment as usual that leads to the difficulties that happen in treatment with BPD patients. Individuals with BPD are very high utilizers of treatment, but they have high dropout rates. They have revolving door hospitalizations, and they don't respond to standard levels of care, which leads to the misconception that they're not treatable. As I was saying, the variability in functioning due to extreme mood shifts and lability and also mood dependency. In other words, individuals with BPD, when they're in a good mood, they can function quite highly, some of them, a lot of them. They have a lot of strength. They're usually highly intelligent and very creative, and they can even be very high achieving. But when they're in a bad mood, maybe depressed mood, maybe an angry mood or a very anxious mood, or when there's an interpersonal trigger that gets them upset, the level of functioning shifts dramatically. But because there's so much variability, there's a tendency to attribute that their low functioning is more willful and deliberate, and that they're capable of high functioning and they're just choosing not to function at that level. Also, as I was saying, the extreme neediness and help rejecting behavior leading to hostility is very difficult to tolerate, and also challenges the usual frame of treatment. And finally, I think that even though there's research and we're finding a lot more biological and genetic basis for BPD, it's still not as recognized as in Axis 1 disorders as a contributing factor. And medications are not as clearly effective in treating BPD symptoms, so there's still more of a bias to think that BPD is not as biological and genetic as it is environmental, and I think that also adds to a conception that individuals with BPD are deliberately or deciding not to work as hard as they can in treatment to get better. So instead of giving a one size-fits-all kind of treatment approach, it seems that what we need to do in order to make treatment more effective for people with BPD is to make modifications to the way psychotherapy is taught as usual. And most training programs still teach psychotherapy as traditionally, and so they don't have some of those modifications. But one of the first appearances of the term borderline in the psychoanalytic literature was made by Adolf Stern in 1938 when he noticed that there was a particular group of patients, which he called the borderline group, that wasn't responding to psychoanalysis. And he wrote two chapters describing how he had to modify psychoanalysis, and his goal was to make these patients ready to then be able to tolerate and use psychoanalysis. And he instituted a couple of modifications, which he described as making the therapeutic relationship more reality determined. What does that mean? Instead of having the patient lie on the couch and free associate, he would have the patient sit up and look directly at him in the room in order to stay more connected with the relationship. He noticed that these patients had a difficult time tolerating silence, so he decided for this borderline group that he would have no extended silences, and he would fill in and take a more active therapeutic role. He also realized that this group didn't use transference interpretations very well. In other words, if the therapist was suggesting that the patient's behavior had to do with transferring their feelings about someone else to the therapist, that was not workable for these patients, and he made less emphasis on transference interpretations. He realized that these patients needed more sustenance and support. So these modifications are actually the precursors to the types of modifications that other BPD psychotherapies incorporate, DBT in particular, but transference-focused psychotherapy, schema focus, and mentalization, they all incorporate some of these modifications, and as the evidence is showing, they're keeping borderline patients engaged and actually improving in treatment because of it. So for DBT, I'm on the next slide, and I'm sorry I keep losing track of telling you that I'm switching slides, so let me just go back for a minute to tell you which slide I'm on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm on slide number 9. These are the assumptions that DBT has the therapist take towards their borderline patients that incorporate some of the modifications that Adolf Stern recommended. DBT therapists are trained to consider that their patients are doing the best they can and that they want to improve. They need to do better, try harder, and be more motivated to change. They may have not caused their problems, but they have to solve them anyway. Therapists have to remember that patients' lives are unbearable as they are currently being lived. DBT therapy and therapists encourage patients to learn new behavior in all relevant contexts. What that means is, even if you're feeling upset, afraid, ashamed, sad, you still need to behave in a skillful way, that the mood dependency that I was discussing shouldn't get in the way of being skillful. Another very important, I'm on the next slide, slide 10, another important assumption is that patients cannot fail in therapy. The treatment fails or the therapist fails. And finally, the therapist treating patients with borderline personality disorder needs support. So these are the main assumptions that I think lead to destigmatizing BPD. And if therapists can be exposed to looking at their BPD patients from this perspective as early on as possible in their training, then we're going to have a lot more well-trained clinicians out there that will not stigmatize, and they'll be willing and able to work with these patients and learn how to avoid getting burnt out and keeping the patients engaged in treatment. So that's the objective of the DBT training in our curriculum is for the residents to develop a non-stigmatized view of BPD and the ability to increase empathy for these patients, and that they will take more responsibility for treatment success and failure with their patients, and that they'll learn effective interventions for managing self-harm behaviors, for learning how to distinguish suicide attempts from non-suicidal self-injury, from learning how to provide support for people who are at risk, who have chronic suicidal ideation, how to keep them safe on an outpatient basis. And an objective also is for increased willingness and confidence to treat BPD among residents, and I'm on the next slide, I'm sorry. And also, the final objective is for the residents to have an increased understanding of the evidence base for DBT. So the main teaching points that we try to cover in the curriculum is to really try to drive home the DBT assumptions about treating BPD. And I'm on the next slide. To help these therapists learn how to validate their patients. And that's a very huge intervention of DBT, as you probably know, is that DBT therapists are trained to explicitly search for whatever is possibly valid in their patient's experience and to highlight it and to emphasize it. We teach the residents how to synthesize validation and totally accepting their patients the way they are, and also pushing them to change and to improve their lives through learning skills. We make sure that residents learn how to do psychotherapy and take a very active, directive therapeutic stance, which is really different from how they're learning how to do psychotherapy in other modalities, that they're taught how to take a more neutral stance where they're quiet and they're letting the patient guide the session. But in DBT, therapists learn to listen very closely to their patients, but also take a very active, directive therapeutic stance in order to teach them skills and to keep them focused on their goals and moving forward. Also to eliminate those silences that are very hard to tolerate. We also train the residents to actively psychoeducate their patients to their BPD diagnosis and to learning skills. And when I was trained by Otto Kernberg, before I did DBT training, I was never taught to directly discuss the BPD diagnosis with my patients. And that's been something that I've learned in DBT, which has been very eye-opening for me. I think people are afraid, because of the stigma, to directly tell somebody that they might have the disorder. But if you are doing it in a non-judgmental fashion, it's very validating for most patients to hear that there's a name for what they're experiencing that seems to make total sense, and there's a therapeutic approach that was designed specifically to address the kinds of difficulties that they're having. So that's new for a lot of the residents and a lot of clinicians. DBT also requires the clinician to be available for between-session contact and skills coaching. So that's also a modality that they're not learning in other types of psychotherapy training, and we teach that. We also teach the residents about the idea of observing natural rather than arbitrary limits. And this has to do with the whole idea of boundary setting. And treatment as usual, the way I was taught before I learned DBT, was that psychotherapy had a frame and the patients needed to fit into that frame. And as soon as they needed something that was outside of the frame, such as calling between sessions, that was interpreted as a pathological neediness. So, again, DBT kind of opens that up and says, you know, patients have needs and therapists have these arbitrary ideas based on their training that make them unwilling or unable to necessarily meet their patients' needs. And that Sometimes patients have needs and therapists cannot meet that need, but it shouldn't be because of an arbitrary idea about what the therapist should be doing. It should be based on what the therapist feels that they can do. And DBT invites therapists to think about opening up their limits and seeing what they are really able and willing to do, and maybe they'll be able to meet some of the needs their patients have and without pathologizing it and make the patient feel like they shouldn't be having this need because therapists don't do these things. I can give more examples of that later if that's a question. The final modality that we try to make a point of in this curriculum is to have the team of therapists meet as a consultation team. So we don't have individual supervision. In DBT, all the therapists and psychopharmacologists who are doing DBT meet as a team, and that's a very unique experience for the residents as well, and it's a feature of the DBT training that they were very surprised to find that they enjoyed very much. They really got closer as a group, and they covered for each other's patients, and they co-led skills groups together, and it was a unique experience, and they felt very supportive of each other, and they felt that they were able to handle some of the stresses of their patients much better because they had this team approach. So I'm on the next slide. The program itself is a 12-month curriculum. It's an elective to residents either in the third or fourth resident year. And we start it in the summer when in the new rotation is July 1st. We have a 15-hour clinical intensive training in the summer. And then after the summer, we start the team meetings, the two-hour team meetings every week where our residents come together and discuss cases. Each resident has 1 to 2 individual cases, and then they rotate co-leadership of a DBT skills training group. So in the team meeting, I'm on the next slide, we review the individual cases, and then we review what's going on in the DBT skills group. We have ongoing didactics as well. We read from Marsha Linehan's text or from the skills training manual or other articles that have been written since those publications in order to keep, as the residents are having the experience of doing the clinical work, they can start to incorporate some other clinical concepts and especially behavioral techniques since they're not getting that anywhere else in their training, at least at Columbia. It's a very psychoanalytic and psychodynamic program. So just reviewing basic behavioral principles is also helpful going forward during the year. Residents also videotape their psychotherapy sessions, partly because that's for the evaluation piece of this grant that I'm going to be reviewing the tapes. I start reviewing them and coding them to make sure that they're learning how to do DBT. But we also use it for supervision, that in the team we might watch parts of a videotape session and discuss the types of DBT that we're seeing happening or ways in which they can incorporate more DBT in the session. Next slide. So just to share some preliminary results with you, each of the trainees have had a lot of challenges. Almost every resident that we had had to tolerate chronic suicidal ideation, suicide threats, between session phone calls. So they really did experience what it's like to be available in the way that DBT asks the therapist to be available, and found it quite challenging. Despite the challenges, the trainees have reported that they have a greater ability to feel empathy for and to manage negative reactions towards their BPD patients. And they have developed greater confidence and effectiveness in managing suicide risk. They also feel that DBT gave them tools to understand self-destructive behavior and to intervene, learning the skills. DBT also teaches therapists how to set the agenda at the beginning of a session so that the session can at least have a roadmap. And even if you're going to deviate from the roadmap, at least the agenda lets you know that you're deviating and you have a way of trying to bring the session back to addressing the goal so that each session can be working towards the individual's goal. And most of you probably know that DBT also has the patient using a diary card where the patient records their feelings or behaviors that they're targeting in their treatment, and they bring that diary card in every week, and that's part of how the session gets organized, is around the diary card. The therapist learns to review the diary card, find out what happened during the week, and that the agenda gets set based on what has happened. Individual therapy also in DBT includes learning how to do a behavioral analysis, so that's a change intervention that is also unique to the residents. They don't learn that in any other aspects of their training, where they learn how to take a target behavior, for example, a self-harm behavior, and conduct a behavioral analysis that allows them to identify triggers for the behavior, vulnerabilities that the patient may have had that led to the behavior, and thoughts and feelings and behaviors, body sensations, distorted interpretations. A behavioral analysis helps the therapist and patient collaborate together to explore and to break down a self-harm episode into these parts so that skills can be used to target interpretations, behaviors, vulnerabilities. So these are all skills that the residents don't learn in any other aspect of their training. The other very important piece is that the residents have reported having more of a comfort level with being available between sessions and being able to observe their personal boundaries and still make themselves available. So that's one of the big challenges that I think a lot of clinicians, whether they're trainees or senior clinicians, seasoned clinicians, that they assume that making yourself available in this way is going to lead to burnout. So I think one of the most important parts of this training is teaching residents and any clinician how to make themselves available and not get burnt out. I've done DBT training with clinicians who, even though they haven't been trained to be available between session, they're working with people with BPD or eating disorders, and those patients call between session because they have needs. These patients, you know, are very emotionally dysregulated and behaviorally dysregulated, and it's very hard for them to maintain stable functioning, you know, with once-a-week sessions without some kind of support during the week. So many of the clinicians I know and who I've trained find themselves on the phone for a very long time with their patient, but they get very burnt out by it because they don't have the training of how to manage those contacts. And so the DBT training really helps prevent burnout by giving clinicians a way of learning how to observe their boundaries and still keep their patients feeling supported and stable. So that's a huge result, to have clinicians being willing and able to have that kind of contact with their patients. The residents have reported a lot of personal growth as a therapist because DBT asks you to think outside the box and to not just follow the traditional frame of therapy and to really think hard about how can I as a therapist respond to my patient's need and feel okay about it, even if it's not what I was taught that I should do as a therapist. That really helped them learn to think about who they were as a therapist. They were able to have a more positive therapy experience. They saw progress. They were able to have hope for their patients, and they actually were able to like their patients. And they felt very supported by the DBT consultation team. Next slide. So these are not my findings from our study. We're in the process now. We're in the fourth year of a five-year grant, and we are just starting the evaluation phase. We are actually giving a survey to all of the residents who come through the Columbia Residency Program to survey their attitudes about treating people with BPD and with suicidal behavior. And we're just starting to collect the before and after surveys of their attitudes. So whether or not they've taken the DBT, and what I'd like to do is compare the residents who chose the DBT elective to see how their attitudes have changed over the time versus the residents who didn't take that training. So this graph here that I have posted is based on one other residency program in the University of Washington, Seattle, where Marsha Linehan's colleague, Kate Comtois, and her colleague, Dr. Fredericks, did a year-long curriculum with residents there as well, and then they contacted them after their graduation from residency, and they wanted to see how the confidence to treat suicidal ideation and BPD was affected by their participation in DBT training. So as you can see, their curriculum was different than ours. They had a workshop. They had a workshop and actual practice where they had patients and were supervised, and they had a seminar. So for the most part, the confidence to treat chronic suicidal ideation and people with BPD was higher with the people who had more DBT training in that group. And also, the ones who had more DBT training during their residency were more likely to use DBT strategies. So we're hoping to have similar results when we're going to evaluate that, and we're also going to evaluate how well the residents actually learned the DBT by rating their videotape. So another goal of our grant is to disseminate this curriculum and hope that we can get other residency training programs to start teaching DBT to their trainees. So we've presented it at the annual Conference of Psychiatry Residency Directors and also at the APA last year. Just this week, an article describing the curriculum, as well as an article by the residents who have been through the program, was published in Psychiatric Annals, so you should try to take a look at it. Two residents who were part of the first year, the first group, described their experience in detail, and I think if you see that article, you can see how they describe how much the DBT training helped them develop a sense of empathy towards their patients and feeling of confidence of being able to help them. Barbara Stanley and I are about to publish a book. It should be coming out in the fall that has a lot of these ideas in it about how to train trainees and clinicians who are interested in DBT to incorporate some of these assumptions and the ability to validate and to learn how to make yourself available. So that book is coming out. I've been asked to consult with various residency programs across the country to develop similar curricula and training. And as I said, we're currently rating the videotapes and conducting surveys to further evaluate this program. So I think that's it. Just these are the acknowledgments, and I'm very happy to field any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Thank you so much for such a clear presentation. The switchboard, if you will, is lighting up with an array of questions. But I have to pass on a comment. This is the salvation that we've been waiting for, to have mental health professionals up to date and understanding and being able to be effective with borderline instead of being laden with stigma and negativism and ineffective methods. What can we do, is the question, to help you and others get this desperately needed transformation out and accomplished?
I think maybe local clinics, I know that I've been asked to train people in the Institute for Contemporary Psychotherapy in Manhattan, for example. They have a training program, and they asked me to teach their trainees. So any clinics that you know of in your areas, you know, to encourage them to try to identify a DBT-trained person in your area, you can go to the Behavioral Tech website and maybe try to see if you can get some training going on in the local mental health places. I think that would be a good place to start.
Okay, I'm going to hop around, Beth. I hope you don't mind, just to cover the range. Then,
sure.
We do that, then we can go into more depth, deeper with some of the particular topics. There's a question about the appeal of DBT. It has several aspects. One is, do you consistently use DBT, or do you use other procedures and methods from other psychotherapy from time to time? And if so, for what?
Okay. I personally, since I was trained before DBT, I was trained in the precursors of the transference-focused psychotherapy for borderline personality disorder. I do sometimes incorporate some of my psychodynamic training when I feel that it's appropriate. So, of course, when I'm doing it in a research setting, I'm very adherent to the DBT model, and I'm doing straight DBT. In my private practice, I do incorporate sometimes, you know, I don't do much dream interpretation, but I think sometimes the transference interpretations or exploring possible unconscious or subconscious motivations, sometimes I incorporate that in trying to understand and make the right interpretations about what's going on. So I would say yes, I probably do that more than somebody who is trained just as a cognitive behavior therapist. But I don't want to, personally, I don't want to get trained in too many other methods, because I think that the evidence base is based on doing the treatment the way it's supposed to be done. I would like to know a little bit more and maybe incorporate some mentalization, but I think that can go along with DBT as well.
Okay. What about medications? Do you have a psychiatrist that you coordinate with for medications, and if so, for what?
I do. I have a number of psychiatrists that I collaborate with. I have one in particular because he's not formally trained in DBT, but he knows a lot about it, and he really knows how to take that non-stigmatized view towards BPD patients. And so sometimes it's a challenge to find the right psychiatrist. That's another reason why this curriculum developed, is because now that I've trained some and they've graduated, these are the kinds of people I want to refer my patients to, because I know that they understand these concepts, and they're going to be validating, and they're going to not be as anxious about and quick to hospitalize when it's not necessary. For sure, to hospitalize when necessary, because hospitalization can save a life when there's an imminent risk, but to really be able to do the work of tolerating some anxiety and trying to keep somebody, an outpatient, with a lot of support to stay safe. And these psychiatrists that I work with me to do that, so I think that we don't make as many unnecessary hospitalization decisions as we might otherwise.
That's good. Then another phase of this concerns income for the therapist. Is DBT can involve potentially, it would seem, a lot more therapist time. Is that compensated or not compensated? And if it's not paid for, doesn't this constitute a major deterrent to adopting or continuing with DBT?
Wow, okay. I think it's really important to figure out what your fee is that you know that you feel you can maintain a positive alliance with your patient and not to be feel resentful. So in private practice, I have, it's a high fee. It's not higher than most very well-trained clinicians in Manhattan. But that covers whatever contact I have with the patient. I think it's really anti-DBT to charge somebody for every time they call you for coaching, because then you're going to, it's like an aversive consequence for actually calling for help and doing the right thing. So the fee covers whatever contact I have with the patient. You know, maybe other DBT therapists do it differently, but that's, I feel very strongly about that. It is unfortunate that there's not much low DBT, low fee DBT available. People need it, and but it is labor intensive. So that's kind of a dialectic that we still have to synthesize in terms of providing good care at affordable rates. But I think I think individuals with BPD are the ones that present the most for clinical treatment. So again, clinicians may choose to try not to treat people with BPD, but if you are going to treat people with BPD, DBT actually makes you use less time, I think, than if you were not making yourself available, because you're more likely to run into problems that will ultimately cause a lot more time and energy. So a 5-minute phone call for coaching, or 5 or 10 minute phone call for coaching, when you learn how to use the phone coaching protocol, is not a lot of time, and it prevents a lot of problems. So that's why once you're trained to think this way, it doesn't feel like a burden to be available. It feels like a good thing. You don't want to see your patient coming in a week later and said, I hurt myself, and you didn't get a chance to help them. If they call you for coaching, they use the skills, they avert a crisis, that's positively reinforcing for the therapist as well, and it doesn't feel like a burden.
Okay. The question, do you have a DBT consultation support group for your private practice and work?
I have one peer. That's Barbara Stanley is my team. So we serve that for each other. We consult with each other about our patients. Having a team on a private practice basis has been a challenge, but the behavioral tech organization is starting to fill that need, and there's actually online teams starting. So people from all over the country are forming teams online. So that's been a good development and something that I'm looking into for myself. But also being in the research environment that I'm in and having my colleagues there, I do have kind of an impromptu team that I use.
Okay. With DBT, what's the hardest part of DBT to teach to psychiatrists successfully?
I think the biggest challenge is getting them to make the switch from the training that they've had to look at people with BPD as provocative and manipulative, and that whenever they're problematic, that it's their problem and they're the cause of their problem. So, you know, those the DBT assumptions, it takes a long time to have them make the switch to think, to be more validating and to stop using that kind of, they don't think, it doesn't even feel pejorative to them. They don't hear that it sounds pejorative to use those terms. So I would say that, and you would think that the being available for between session coaching would be difficult, but I find that that's more difficult among more seasoned clinicians, because residents are working all the time, and their hours are so long, so they actually don't balk at that as much as you would think.
Oh, oh, that's true. Do you have any feel where the psychiatry residents are getting these outmoded notions about DBT from?
You mean BPD?
BBT, excuse me, word line.
I think that as much as things, you know, when you're involved in BPD and all of the new therapies that are being developed, you don't realize that there's still traditional training going on that, I mean, that just doesn't incorporate some of these modifications that I was talking about. So they're learning therapy as usual, which is not supposed to, you know, I don't think they think that it's pejorative or stigmatizing. These are just clinical terms that people use, resistance and manipulative and provocative, and they don't necessarily recognize it as judgmental. They think it's descriptive. You know, I'm hoping that having the DBT training is going to hopefully affect that milieu as well, but it's just a different way of thinking that still hasn't caught on everywhere.
Yeah, I've got notes here. You know, oh my God, how do we get the news story out to people to change their view of things?
It's changing. Some people are really, you know, learning these therapies, and then some aren't. It's almost like, I think, you know, like I don't know that much about treating schizophrenia, honestly. I mean, sometimes somebody comes into my office, and I don't realize that they might actually, in addition to BPD, they might have schizoaffective, and I have to get consultation for people who are more trained in that. So people choose to work with certain populations, and the people who are more interested in working with BPD are definitely, you know, the stigma is lifting, but other people are still thinking they're treating obsessive compulsive and anxiety disorders and depression, and they're not as much immersed in the new thinking about BPD because that's not their area.
Right. Oh, here's this is a good, what's particularly satisfying about treating borderlines?
Well, I think that they're much more emotionally present than some of the more high-level neurotic functioning people who have trouble identifying their emotions. They're very emotionally present. And I also think that even though, I think one thing I didn't say about DBT and what we try to help teach the residents as well is to learn how to measure progress in smaller increments. And so once you learn how to measure progress in smaller increments, you really learn to see the progress. And I see them making a lot of progress. Not always, but a lot of times, yes. And it's a privilege to see people who are struggling with such, you know, deep emotional dysregulation to actually learn how to get control and use the skills and how hard they work. I mean, I am very inspired by a lot of the patients that I work with, and they're also very funny and creative. I mean, they've got a lot of passion. They're just very alive in a lot of ways that I didn't always see before I was treating.
Oh, that's a very positive perspective. I've got one here I've got to tell you is, how do we clone Dr. This is just a general question. How do we clone Dr. Rotsky to put her presence at the psychiatry residency programs across the country, the schools of social work, and the schools of clinical psychology? So,
well,
you're really in demand. Have you got a complete DNA that we could use?
Oh, that's very nice. But, you know, there's a lot of us out there. I'm going to meet a bunch of them in New York this week, and they're coming from all over the country, and I think even from Europe to train with Marcia. So I think, you know, there are a lot of us, and I think that's why NIMH funded this project, is to give us a way to develop this and then to disseminate it. I'm going to go to their psychiatry residency training program in Dayton, Ohio in September to talk to their staff, and I'm hoping to have other opportunities to visit other training programs.
Great. Just keep your energy level up. I had a note from Perry. She wonders how we can get a hold of copies of the papers that you referenced. And you can answer that offline, but because I need to conclude, and thank you so much for sharing this really uplifting. I think it's really buoyed spirits to know that this kind of change effort is underway, and it's so badly needed and so acute, and that someone with your expertise and wisdom and energy is at the key pin of this with others and doing this wonderful change. And thank you so much for making your Sunday evening available to share with the borderline community.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Have a great week. Everybody have a fine week. Tune in, call in next Sunday. And bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.